and float downstream to where Norris and the Sea Commandos, disguised as VC in black pajamas and carrying AKs, would be waiting. But an NVA patrol arrived at the rendezvous, and the team had to let Clark float past. Norris' men crept around more NVA patrols and found Clark at dawn exhausted in shallow water. They brought him back to Cam Low. Lieutenant Colonel Hambleton, too, was supposed to float downstream, but it had taken every bit of the 53-year-old's stamina just to reach the river. After 10 days, virtually without food, he'd lost 45 pounds, but still managed to creep and crawl a mile in pitch darkness. Due to his injuries and exhaustion, however, he could not go on. Norris and the Sea Commandos would have to go after Hambleton on the next night. By now, several Sea Commandos had grown skittish, and only one volunteered to accompany Norris the second night, Petty Officer Nguyen Van Kiet. In the darkness, the two of them boarded an abandoned sampan and, disguised as fishermen, paddled quietly upriver. In the foggy darkness, they accidentally went all the way to the bustling Cam Lo Bridge, where tanks and many troops were crossing, and they had to turn back. Finally, they found Hambleton lying under a bush at the riverbank, delirious. They lifted the emaciated flyer into the sampan and hid him beneath leaves and branches and paddled away. Several times they coasted quietly past NVA sentries. Then just before dawn, an enemy soldier began waving and shouting at them, ordering them to land. They pretended not to hear him. By dawn they were almost back at the Arvin outpost when a heavy machine gun opened up from the far bank. They took cover in high reeds and called in A1s on the gun, then directed a pair of Phantoms to cover their final run-in. They landed safely. By chance, a CBS News reporter arrived just as Hambleton was being carried away and said to Norris, "It must have been tough out there. I bet you wouldn't do that again." The SOG SEAL's eyes flashed. An American was down in enemy territory. "Of course I'd do it again." He turned and left. His retort delighted Chief SOG Colonel Sadler, who said, "Oh, he was a tough, cocky little fucker. Fine man." From his hospital bed in the Philippines, Hambleton told reporters, "I never lost hope." When he learned the men lost trying to save him, he added, "It was a hell of a price to pay for one life. I'm very sorry." Lieutenant Tom Norris received SOG's only SEAL Medal of Honor. His courageous subordinate, Nguyen Van Kiet, was awarded the Navy Cross, equal to the Army Distinguished Service Cross, the only Vietnamese to receive so high a U.S. award. 2 weeks later, MACV disbanded SOG's Naval Advisory Detachment. Why had so many SOG POW rescue missions failed? Colonel Bobby Pinkerton chalked much of it up to late intelligence. "The common problem with all the JPRC operations was late intelligence. We never got timely intelligence." Major Ed Lassane elaborates on the problem. "Most of the intelligence we got was very perishable," he said, "because you're taking a snapshot of a moving train, the whole enemy logistics system, the whole Ho Chi Minh Trail system, everything they did, they kept on the move." And certainly the enemy frequently moved American POWs. But that only partly explains some troubling statistics. During the entire war, SOG-initiated raids liberated 492 Arvin, but not one living American. By sheer chance, there should have been, say, 10%, 49 Americans rescued. Even at 1%, it would have been 5 Americans. Why not even 1 American? A sickening likelihood arises, reminiscent of the doubled agent teams in North Vietnam. Compromise. SOG had been penetrated. The identities of the moles would soon come to light. 16. Fighting soldiers from the sky. In SOG's first bright light mission, in 1966, two VC battalions massacred Huckleberry Lewis and Charlie Vessels and their entire platoon. In all but one subsequent POW rescue raid, Chief SOG Jack Singlob noted, "The evidence was that the Americans had left within an hour, or just a few hours before we got there." Singlob began to wonder. "For a long time I thought it was operational security," he added, meaning inadvertent disclosures through radio messages, conspicuous overflights and such. Disclosure could not have happened through an enemy mole, Singlob believed, because the only Arvin officer outside SOG he told of these missions was chairman of the Joint Staff General Cao Van Vien, a courtesy recommended by General Westmoreland. Vien promised to tell no one. Just to be safe, Singlob disclosed nothing to Vien until 24 hours before an operation, so the enemy wouldn't have enough time to react even if Vien leaked it. U.S.-led recon teams had been compromised too, thought Major Ed Ribot, the FOB-1 commander, observing that often it looked like they knew we were coming. By 1969, the problem had grown so that Singlob's replacement, Colonel Steve Cavanaugh, too, initially thought it an operational security shortcoming. Cavanaugh personally visited each FOB to ask the 1-0s what could be done to keep their teams on the ground, and he brought in the Army Security Agency, ASA, to monitor SOG radios and phones. I sat through the February 1969 ASA debrief conducted by the 101st Radio Research Company, which found very pressing requirements for secure voice communications in all MAC SOG systems. The Saigon staff seemed convinced this was a solution, but most recon men already were careful about encrypting and disclosing nothing on the radio. After all, they were the ones who would die. The teams knew the NVA was monitoring their radios, verified beyond question on an occasion when an evading RT switched on an emergency radio and heard it in stereo, another emergency radio, in the hands of an NVA officer just 30 yards away, was repeating the beep, beep, beep of their beacon. They shut off their radio and crept away. Cavanaugh concluded the radio security problem was serious, so in mid-1969, he directed that teams carry the KY-38 secure voice system, a 50-pound device as big as a shopping bag that connected to a team's normal PRC-25 radio. Just as certainly as Cavanaugh believed the KY-38s would help recon men, the men believed the bulky units endangered them by slowing their movement. Unsure where the compromises originated, recon men took no chances. 1-0 Steve Kiever decided, if we were going to send in a coordinate, we were going to be 200 meters north of that. The practice was widespread. Another way to improve recon team survival, Chief SOG Cavanaugh thought, was inserting teams beyond SOG's 20-kilometer limit. They had our LZs pretty well pegged, he said. I finally went back to Washington and asked for authority to insert deeper, and I would have got it but for U.S. Ambassador to Laos, William Sullivan. We were supposed to let the embassy in Laos know every time we were putting a team in, which we did. Maybe that was where we were getting compromised. I don't know. What else could be done? One possibility was night landings. There were no enemy LZ watchers at night because Hueys and Kingbees couldn't land safely in darkness. But teams could parachute in darkness, and that would complicate NVA countermeasures considerably. Thus, when RT Auger 1-0 Frank Oppel requested permission to parachute into Cambodia's fishhook in December 1969, SOG headquarters approved it immediately. The only problem was, when Oppel went to his 1-1 with the good news, the 1-1 said he wouldn't go. Oppel had to find a replacement. That night he invited his old friend Bob Graham to play Chinese checkers and drink, their favorite avocations. While Oppel sipped his scotch and root beer, he plied his friend with liquor and let him get ahead in the game. Then the unscrupulous Oppel described his coming airborne adventure, the first in the history of CCS, and told how his own 1-1 had failed him. How could the drunken Graham resist? "Well, shit, Frank, I'll go with you," he said. The sucker was snared. First thing next morning, Oppo rushed to tell the S3 that he'd found another Man of Steel. Then he went to Graham to announce, "Well, we're on." The previous night's liquor had wiped clean Graham's short-term memory. "What are you talking about?" "We're making that combat jump."
"Are you crazy?"
Graham shrieked. But he vaguely recalled the foolish promise, and the next thing he knew, the two Americans and three Nungs were shooting up for their first practice jump from a USAF Green Hornet Huey. After a week of daytime drops and one final night rehearsal jump, it became the real thing. At 4 a.m., 23 December 1969, they leaped from a Green Hornet into Cambodia. They landed and linked up quickly, but one Nung had a broken ankle. Later that morning, a helicopter arrived to lift him out, wiping away any benefits from R.T. Auger's stealthy night jump, so the entire team was extracted. A parachute insertion was a good idea, everyone agreed, but only if it went perfectly. That same December, Colonel Kavanaugh brought in an operational security survey team from the Pacific Theater headquarters in Hawaii to study possible sources of enemy prior knowledge and ways to deny the enemy these sources. After 3 weeks, the survey team found SOG procedures and practices more secure than any of the organizations and activities surveyed during the past 3 years. Clearly, SOG was not telegraphing its punches. But while SOG headquarters reflected and studied, recon men had come to their own conclusions. Teams were being compromised. "Absolutely," said 10 Dick Gross. "They were compromised out of Saigon." "How?" "They had to have an agent in there." His opinion was widely shared. Statistics supported this suspicion. During the second quarter of 1970, every team inserted west of Khe San was hit. In the next quarter, teams were inserted there 74 times, and 2 out of 3 made significant contact. There was little likelihood the compromise was at Da Nang, Con Tum, or Ban Me Thot, simply because Vietnamese had little access to operational data. SOG's top secret documents were stamped "No Foreign," meaning no foreign dissemination, and that included South Vietnamese. Former Ban Me Thot 10 Frank Burkhardt thought that was true in Saigon, too, until he served on liaison duty there in 1970. Each morning, Burkhardt picked up an envelope at SOG headquarters and delivered it to an Arvin major across town. When he learned the contents, he almost fainted. The previous night's U.S. team situation reports, or SITREPs, which included their grid locations. "I couldn't believe it," he said. "We gave them the locations of our teams. There's no doubt in my mind that Charlie had it as fast as we had it. No doubt." Burkhardt learned U.S. intelligence had intercepted messages from Hanoi to NVA field units, relaying SOG target locations, and he was even polygraphed because he'd had access. But the Arvin were not polygraphed. "Every morning when we gave the SITREPs to that Arvin major, bang! It was going to the NVA just as fast as I was handing it to him." This put the NVA only a few hours behind the teams, with daily updates to fine-tune their search. "Why did Arvin have to know?" "There was a big thing then," Burkhardt explained, "that this wasn't our country and they were our counterparts and all that kind of bullshit." Chief SOG could have cut off Arvin access, but overnight the flap would have escalated to President Nguyen Van Thieu, and drawn in the ambassador, General Abrams, perhaps the White House. But teams were vanishing. Kavanaugh had to do something. "I suddenly began to realize we were compromising them," Kavanaugh said. "No question about it." So he started misleading the Arvin, letting them believe a team was to be inserted at one point when the real LZ was some distance away. And then, when the mission went out to the field, it was different, Kavanaugh said. Once the team was on the ground, he'd explain to the Arvin that weather or ground fire had caused a shift or someone had made a mistake. But once a team was inserted, The deception had to end because the Vietnamese could cross-check the location through King B crews or Vietnamese Air Force strike reports. It was the most Kavanaugh and his successor, Colonel John Sadler, could do. I would say every effort consistent with basic military common sense was used to keep the Arvin from knowing it, Sadler said, but sometimes you couldn't prevent it. Like an evangelist, Burkhart carried his revelation to every recon man he could, warning them to report their true location only to the Covey FAC, and to falsify other reports, especially the Daily Sitrep. Just you and the FAC, he urged. That's all it has to know where you really are. Meanwhile, evidence of intelligence leaks continued to build. On 10 October 1970, a CCN team was extracted soon after landing when a shocking NVA radio message was overheard. The team just landed, an enemy officer reported. Everybody move up. The RT was extracted. Then the enemy radioed, "The team is going back. Everybody stay alert." It was undeniable proof that the enemy had lain in wait. Down in Saigon, Chief Sog Sadler decided it was time for a completely different approach. Since the first German combat jumps in 1940, paratroopers always had gone into battle using static lines to open chutes automatically as they exited the aircraft, allowing masses of troopers to land in a predictable pattern at a predictable rate. But there was another option. As one of the Army's foremost parachuting experts, Sadler had served on the airborne board at Fort Benning and during the Korean War experimented with what civilians call skydiving and the military calls HALO, high altitude low opening, parachuting, exiting above 10,000 feet, free falling to 1,000 or 2,000 feet, then gliding the rest of the way using a steerable parachute. Though Special Forces HALO training had begun in 1957, and Sadler himself became HALO qualified a year later, no military unit, U.S. or foreign, had yet used HALO in combat. Much Special Forces interest in HALO was for the precision delivery of SADM, Special Atomic Demolition Munitions, behind enemy lines. Each Special Forces group outside Vietnam included a HALO SADM team to emplace these suitcase nukes. Although Sadler found several HALO advocates on his SOG staff, especially Colonels Bobby Pinkerton and Dan Shungle, there was still general opposition to its employment in SOG. At SOG headquarters, Billy Waugh said, "People thought HALO was crazy as hell because they didn't go on the ground themselves and didn't realize that if you could get in quietly, without notification to the bad guys, that you could have something." A solid HALO supporter, Waugh asked to be inserted, "By school bus or submarine, but don't make me go by helicopter into the damned Ashaw. Let's change it. Change it." In July 1970, Colonel Sadler decided to change it and authorized Billy Waugh to select the world's first combat HALO team. Staff Sergeant Cliff Newman and Sergeant First Class Sammy Hernandez were on a recon mission with RT Virginia near Khe Sanh when they were told to go to the nearest LZ for extraction. They had no idea what was happening until Billy Waugh met their returning helicopter and announced he had a special mission for them. But Sammy Hernandez didn't like being volunteered before he even knew what the hell was going on. The gritty Waugh would hear none of that. "Well, you always come whining to me about I want to do something good, baby. You won't let me do nothing good." "Well," Waugh announced, "here it is." A HALO school graduate with 75 jumps under his belt, Hernandez was a natural choice. Cliff Newman was not HALO qualified, but had hundreds of sports skydives and a reputation for being good in the air. Of equal importance, both had extensive recon experience and were accustomed to operating as a team. To fill out the team, Waugh added Sergeant First Class Melvin Hill, who'd recently spent a month with him helping defend a cut-off Cambodian army outpost at Ba Kev. Though Hill didn't have much recon experience, he'd been a HALO instructor at Fort Bragg, and Waugh knew him to be a reliable, dedicated NCO. Next, they needed two Montagnards. a task entrusted to Sammy Hernandez, who announced to RT Virginia's indigenous soldiers, "We're going to jump out of airplanes." "No problem, no problem," the yards assured him. Hernandez explained, "We're going to go real high. We're going to jump, then you fall a certain time, and you have to pull open your own parachute." One yard blinked, looked at him and said, "No, no, I don't think we're going to do that." Still, two Montagnards volunteered, and an Arvin officer was added who, combined with the three Americans, made a six-man team, designated RT Florida. Though Cliff Newman was outranked by Hill and Hernandez, he was the most experienced man, so by SOG ethic, he was 1-0. A SOG Blackbird carried RT Florida to Okinawa for basic HALO training. They were kept hidden in a fenced isolation area, not just for operational security, but because the yards and Arvin officer were there without Japanese authorization. Assisted by the 1st Special Forces Group's finest HALO instructors, Sergeants First Class Joe Markham and Ben Dennis, they began with high-altitude chamber testing to ensure all could withstand a low-oxygen, low-pressure physical environment. In the classroom, they learned it takes 12 seconds for a falling body to reach terminal velocity, 125 miles per hour, or 183 feet per second. HALO had two phases of controlled descent. First, the free fall, during which a jumper had to stabilize and travel laterally to follow or group with others, and then the parachute descent, using canopy gores that could be opened and closed with toggle lines to steer the final 2,500 feet to the drop zone, DZ. Thus, a 12,500-foot jump meant 60 seconds in free fall, opening the chute at 2,500 feet, and another 2.5 minutes flying the canopy into the DZ. Next, they learned the mechanics of free fall, how to stabilize using a modified frog position, contort their bodies into a semi-delta to become flying wings, to perform body turns or glide in a controlled lateral descent. Initially, the yards had trouble stabilizing, but eventually they got the hang of it. Just in case the yards became confused, their rip cores were equipped with an altimeter timer to open their chutes automatically. RT Florida made several jumps daily, sometimes two before dawn, with special emphasis on grouping in the air and following the lead or baseman as he fell toward the DZ. After a month on Okinawa, they returned to Camp Long Tan for another 14 days training, especially in tactics, and made more HALO jumps. One night, Sammy Hernandez drifted far from SOG's airfield and landed on the roof of a U.S. unit's orderly room. Just as he bounced to the ground, the unit first sergeant ran out. The first sergeant took one look at Sammy. Parachute draped around him, goggles covering his eyes, armed to the teeth with Car 15, sawed-off shotgun, sawed-off grenade launcher, dagger, grenades. Thought it was a communist airborne invasion, and keeled over with a heart attack. To help RT Florida, Colonel Sadler brought over Master Sergeant Frank Norbury from the HALO school at Fort Bragg, the same man who'd put him through HALO training in 1958. Until now, it hadn't been realized how canned the Fort Bragg HALO training was, nor its truly experimental status. Genuine combat conditions, with heavily loaded men free-falling into an unmarked strange DZ in almost complete darkness, had never been adequately simulated at Fort Bragg. "We didn't have any book to tell how to do it," Billy Waugh said. "We were writing the book." Darkness caused many problems. The aircrew and jumpmaster had difficulty finding the DZ, yet the Blackbird could make just one pass. The lead jumper or baseman had to see the DZ so everyone could follow him to it. The parachutists had to find each other and group together mid-air, then stay together during the descent. They had to avoid injury while landing in the dark, and they had to link up in thick jungle. The slightest miscalculation in any step would quash the entire operation. The biggest problems they soon saw were grouping in the air and finding each other after they landed. "There was never any doubt in my mind that they could penetrate the jungle," said Colonel Bobby Pinkerton, SOG's operations chief. The problem was how to get them together after they landed. That's where the frustrations were. To find each other in the jungle, Cliff Newman was issued a homing device the size of a cigarette carton, used by agent teams in North Vietnam to find resupply bundles. When he switched it on, his teammates could use ordinary Sony transistor radios tuned to his transponder's frequency and, noting the intensity of its ping, 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 track him down. It worked perfectly. At last, in November, they made a night jump into War Zone D for a 2-day final exercise. Then they were ready. During their mission briefing, RT Florida learned they'd be wiretapping a phone line in Laos beside a new road the NVA was building due west of Chu Lai. At almost the same point, RT Iowa had run SOG's first Shining Brass mission in 1965. Though SOG could not plot individual NVA unit locations, approximately a division, 10,000 troops, were within 10 miles of their DZ. And the closest friendlies, a U.S. 101st Airborne Division firebase, were about 50 miles away. To support the Halo jumpers, SOG brought to bear a special window into the enemy camp unavailable to conventional units, a direct tasking to the NSA through a permanent but unacknowledged NSA liaison officer. With the highest signal intercept priority in Southeast Asia, every NSA asset, from satellites to isolated listening stations, tuned antennas for the slightest word about Halo, parachuting, the jump area, or shifting NVA forces. It saved their lives. RT Florida was ready to go, but the jump was scrubbed because they actually intercepted a message from Saigon to Hanoi with the coordinates and the names of all team members. 10 Newman said, "The mole was back." A new DZ was selected and its location not circulated. Just after midnight of 28 November 1970, RT Florida's team members assembled in a shed at Camp Long Tan to strap on their armaments. Each carried a Car 15, while Newman added a Colt Cobra airweight to Snub Nose and a suppressed 22 high standard. Hernandez couldn't go without his sawed-off shotgun, and there was a general cramming of claymores, knives, grenades, and sawed-off grenade launchers. Then they donned main chutes, reserve chutes, and rucksacks, and waddled aboard their waiting Blackbird. The six-man team, Newman, Hernandez, Hill, 2 yards, and the Arvin officer, took off about 12:30 a.m. The sky was overcast and murky, merging with the Blackbird's dull skin, and even the fleered night vision screen showed the pilots a featureless, stormy landscape. Navigation would be by Doppler radar, bouncing off prominent terrain. The Blackbird navigator, Major Don James, explained, "We tried to do nothing that would seem any different from any other flight. A C-130 had even flown the route for a month. We'd fly a straight, level flight over the drop zone, as if it was a milk run to Thailand." Though they wouldn't jump with oxygen bottles, the Halo men still breathed oxygen from a portable console during their final 30 minutes of flight. Bathed in red light to preserve their night vision, they sprayed temporary luminous paint on their parachute packs to help find each other during descent. Then the jump master, Frank Norbury, signaled 5 minutes out. At 2 a.m., the red lights went out, and the tail ramp opened, dropping the temperature 20 degrees. The Blackbird was cruising at 18,000 feet, which meant the Halo team would freefall 71 seconds, then open at 1,500 feet. Lying on the lowered ramp, Norbury looked hard for landmarks, but it was utterly dark with not even glints off streams visible. It was raining steadily. They'd have to jump using radar. Watching the dark clouds flash past, Sammy Hernandez thought, "I've done a lot of crazy things, but this is the main one here. If I'm going to lose my life, it will probably be on this one." Then it was time to leave the oxygen console and assemble at the ramp in three groups, each with one American, his hand on the shoulder of an Indig standing in front of him. Colonel Pinkerton watched them. "They just looked like a black blob, and they'd grin at you and give you a thumbs up." When Norbury signaled go, they fell gracefully away and instantly plunged from sight. Pinkerton recalls that he thought, what courage it takes to do this, to step out into darkness 2 miles above the jungle, and you don't know what's down there. To any NVA within earshot, it was only a high, passing hum in the dead of night. Then the C-130 was gone. For the jumpers, though, it was anything but graceful or quiet. The wind rushing across him and pressing his face, Cliff Newman looked for landmarks but saw only layer after layer of dark clouds and drifting rain. Above him, Sammy Hernandez scanned desperately for any sign of Newman. Despite the luminous paint, he hadn't seen his 1-0 since he went into the clouds 5 seconds after exiting the aircraft. With 100-mile-per-hour raindrops stinging his face, Mel Hill looked around, but in the darkness and clouds couldn't see anyone, not another soul. Newman opened his chute at 1,500 feet, still in the clouds. He had 2 orange panels in his parachute suspension line to help the others follow him, but that was pointless now. Hernandez couldn't see a single landmark, nor another jumper. When his altimeter indicated 1,500 feet, he pulled his ripcord, deploying the chute. He didn't see the ground coming until he felt himself slide between trees. Then came a wild crashing and snapping of branches, amplified by the quiet of monotonous falling drizzle. For 5 minutes he hung motionless in his harness, then scrambled down, gathered his canopy, and hid it under heavy vegetation. Meanwhile, Newman had landed in a small stream and learned the hard way his homecoming beacon wasn't waterproof. It wouldn't work, making an electronic link-up impossible. He climbed to high ground and fortuitously came upon a Yard teammate. They assembled his 4 elements, Newman and 1 Yard, 1 Yard and the Arvin, then Sammy Hernandez and Mel Hill, each alone. None was injured. When Covey arrived after daylight, the fact determined the Doppler radar had put them 6 miles from their intended DZ, completely off their maps. But that would not stop their mission. As 4 units, they would perform 3 separate recons while Hernandez looked for the landline to wiretap. But they'd have to move cautiously, because the low overcast precluded extraction, and even if it cleared and 1 unit got in trouble, that unit could not safely call in TAC air without endangering the other team members. Carrying his wiretap device, Hernandez carefully picked his way downhill, heavy rain masking his movement, toward where he heard voices and later bulldozers on the road. Then he heard shots to his right and left. Signal shots? Were the NVA onto him? No, he discovered, it was only soldiers hunting for fresh meat. On the 3rd day, Hernandez saw an NVA squad walking along a trail, chattering, weapons on their shoulders, and he smiled. For the first time, he knew the NVA, had no idea they were there. It wasn't until the 4th day that the rain ended, and by then every unit had seen NVA or heard considerable shooting, later thought by analysts to have been marksmanship practice or a tactical exercise. By the 5th morning, Hernandez still hadn't found the large communications wire, and SOG headquarters decided it was time to pull all of them. Thailand-based Jolly Green Giants plucked RT Florida from 4 different LZs, dropping a jungle penetrator to Sammy Hernandez for the final extract. The penetrator lifted him above the treetops, and he saw phantoms shriek past to drop bombs, a pair of A-1s dual with anti-aircraft guns, and more bomb-laden planes circling overhead. Then he was aboard, back with his teammates and safely en route to Nang Khon Phnom. In the movies there'd have been a celebration, but at Nang Khon Phnom it was 1 beer, a warm meal, and then the exhausted men slept. A SOG report concluded Halo had been proven as a means of entering Laos undetected since an active enemy search was not made to locate the team. Of course, there was no public disclosure that the world's first combat Halo jump had been performed. Afterward, Cliff Newman was reassigned to Camp Long Ton as a Halo instructor, and SOG instituted a 3-week Halo course and a 1-week Halo refresher to continue the program. As for that telling signal intercept that had caused the mission to be shifted, no serious mole hunt was conducted, though word of the mole spread among recon ranks. 10 Richard Gross was told, they had all the team members' names, the drop zone, the time of the drop. He wasn't a counterintelligence expert, but Gross had little doubt of the source. Where could that come from? He asked. Saigon. A month later, Chief SOG Colonel Sadler brought in a counterintelligence technical survey team to look for enemy wiretaps and to listen for loose talk on unsecure phone lines. The team found some compromising conversations, but these disclosed nothing about specific operations or specific locations. Security problems, however, continued. As Colonel Roger Petzel, Chief of SOG Cross-Border Operations, observed, I'm sure there was a lot of Trinsat effort against SOG because we were a prime intelligence target. One surprising indicator that the Trinsat, North Vietnam's secret intelligence service, was sharing SOG data with its bloc comrades came when an NCO received a letter from his wife's East German sister who'd been denied permission to marry a communist soldier. The East German security police paid a visit to the sister-in-law, the SOG document notes, and informed her that her brother-in-law is now serving with MAC V SOG in Vietnam. By April 1971, SOG's mole problem even reached the ears of syndicated columnist Jack Anderson, who cited SOG by name and wrote in the Washington Post, it became evident in the fall of 1970 that SOG's surprise raids, planned under the secret code name Prairie Fire, were no longer surprising anyone. Someone began tipping off the enemy exactly where and when to expect the raids, with disastrous results for the raiders. The Anderson column compelled SOG to change its Laos code name from Prairie Fire to Phu Dong, literally opium smoke, which also reflected the growing impact of Vietnamization. Still, no concerted mole search began. But the HALO program continued. In early 1971, a second HALO team was selected, this one led by Captain Larry Maines, a respected two-tour SOG recon veteran and former NCO, and now the CCN recon company commander. To simplify grouping in the air and raise the jumpers' skill levels, this second HALO mission would be entirely American, with only four men. Maines selected three CCN recon men with HALO experience, Specialist 6 Noel Gast, Staff Sergeant Robert Castillo, and Sergeant John Spider Trontanella for his team. Freed of the complications of using Montagnard or Arvin novices, their training went quickly. In the pre-dawn of 7 May 1971, their team flew by Blackbird toward a drop zone inside South Vietnam, midway between the Eshaw Valley and Khe San, where the North Vietnamese were extending Laotian Highway 921 into South Vietnam. It would be an area recon mission. En route to the DZ, they ran into weather so stormy that it seemed the jump would be postponed. When the C-130 tailgate opened at 18,500 feet, the jump master, Frank Norbury, gazed out, then shouted in Maine's ear, "Weather's cleared. It's a go." Looking at the rain and dark clouds, Maines thought Norbury was kidding and kept shaking his head, even as the team unsnapped from the oxygen console and shuffled toward the open door. But Norbury kept nodding yes. Using a technique they'd practiced at Camp Long Tan, Maines and Gast grabbed each other's harnesses and Castillo and Trontanella linked up to freefall as pairs. Then they were off. In the pitch black, all they could see were silhouettes of each other, yet when they opened, I saw all the canopies, Maines reported. We were all together. His toggle lines twisted and unresponsive, Castillo drifted away, but that wasn't their worst problem. A toe-popper mine in Gast's rucksack activated because of the sudden change in atmospheric pressure and exploded when he landed, seriously injuring his back. Trontanella had a bad landing, too. Not long after daylight, a helicopter extracted both of them. Because Castillo was almost a mile away, Maines didn't even try to rendezvous with him. Going their separate ways, they slipped toward the road. They heard a lot of shooting and explosions, and like the first Halo mission, it was thought to be an NVA unit conducting training. They went 4 days without water. On the fifth day, Maines and Castillo were extracted. Their team's insert was apparently undetected, Sog concluded. But the jury was still undecided on Halo. In the first two Halo jumps, only Noel Gast was seriously injured, and that was from a mine, not the jump. The problem remained grouping in the air and landing together. Another Halo team was in training, this one led by that Sog old hand who'd been everywhere and done everything, except a Halo jump. Sergeant Major Billy Waugh. He was hard to keep down, Major Ed Rybat said of the tough old Sergeant Major who refused to sit behind a desk. Joining him would be Staff Sergeant James J.D. Bath and Sergeants Jesse Campbell and Madison Strohline. 4 years earlier, Bath had been Medal of Honor recipient George Sisler's 1-1, gone home, and now was back for another SOG tour. He'd already made a static line jump into Laos, and with nearly 300 military free falls, was the team's strongest jumper. He would be Waugh's baseman and 1-1. Strohline, the youngest at 23, had headed his own recon team and had been wounded twice in the past 6 months. Campbell, too, was a seasoned recon man, with 24 Halo free falls, approximately the same number as Strohline. Bath replaced Staff Sergeant Andre Smith, who'd injured his back in a Halo practice jump at Camp Long Tan. After refresher training on Okinawa, they practiced 1 month at Long Tan, including 10 jumps from Hueys and C-130s, 4 night Halo jumps, and a final exercise in War Zone D. The target SOG selected for them was 60 miles southwest of Da Nang, far beyond any Arvin outpost, practically on the Laotian frontier. Two CCN teams recently had attempted to insert there by chopper. One lasted only 45 minutes, the other had had its Huey shot up on the LZ. USAF infrared photos disclosed numerous NVA cooking fires, while daytime photos showed fresh row crops. In addition to a Car 15, each jumper would carry a sawed-off shotgun or sawed-off grenade launcher, a suppressed pistol, 20 mini-grenades and mini-claymore mines fashioned from soap dishes. As a joke, Jesse Campbell wore captain's bars, and Billy Waugh pinned on a general's star. If the NVA captured them, Waugh told the others, they'll think they've really got something. And if they became separated, Waugh didn't want to hear about it. You've got to have a pair of balls and be able to do it on your own, he told them. From a drop altitude of 19,000 feet, they'd free fall 14,000 feet, over 2 miles, then open at 5,000 feet, just above the area's highest peak, and glide that final mile. Learning from the previous Halo missions, Frank Norbury installed a dull green light on Bath's parachute container so the others could follow him during free fall, with another light atop his parachute canopy for the last phase. Their first insert was canceled due to weather. The second time, they were within 10 seconds of exiting the Blackbird when the mission was scrubbed. It was an eternity, Bath said. Our adrenaline started to mix with anxiety and a whole hell of a lot of fear. On 22 June 1971, they shooted up a third time, climbed into a Blackbird and flew 2 hours toward their DZ. As they neared the release point, the tailgate opened and J.D. Bath lay there beside Larry Maines, their jump master, to try to make out any landmarks. There was supposed to be 8% illumination, but it was solid black. So solid it lacked definition but for a passing cloud. But it wasn't too stormy this night. They'd jump using Doppler radar. Moments later, the four Halo men stood on the edge of the ramp, looked back once to Maines, and on his signal, off they went. Bath, the baseman, saw two jumpers following him, then turned and flipped the toggle switch that controlled his backpack light. He could see the drop zone in the distance and realized the radar had proven inaccurate yet again. As Bath reached 5,000 feet, he flipped the light on and off to signal the others he was at opening altitude. At 4,500 feet, he shut it off and deployed his chute, but it responded sluggishly. He looked up and saw that the opening shock had blown out the canopy center, tearing away the light. He was descending dangerously fast with almost no canopy control. Unable to see Bath's light, Strohline, Campbell, and Waugh drifted away in heavy rain, and though unable to see the others, Waugh made out an NVA truck convoy on a road about 5 miles north, boldly driving with lights on. Though he could feel the temperature rising, Bath couldn't see the ground. Then his chute collapsed on a tree branch, plunging him the last dozen yards, and he hit the ground hard, wrenching his knee and back and knocking him unconscious. Across the ridge where Bath landed, Strohline crashed through the trees and was jerked to a halt. Wall landed in a tree and used his descender to lower himself to the ground in a maddening rain. Campbell, too, went in the trees, but he was safe. When Bath awoke, it was still dark. His back, feet, and legs throbbed painfully, his mouth bled, and his pants were torn. He had a silenced 22 high standard on a cord around his neck that had swung down so that the barrel touched his head. In his confused, groggy state, he thought an NVA soldier had crept up and put a gun in his head. When he saw the truth, he almost laughed. He tried to radio Waugh and Campbell with no response, but he did reach Strohline, and the news wasn't good. Like Bath, Strohline had crashed through the trees, but he'd broken his right arm and could not operate his descender. He was stuck in his harness, high above the jungle floor. With a ridgeline between them, Bath could barely read Strohline's transmissions. And Bath's left ankle was so swollen he couldn't walk, so he put out his claymore, readied grenades, and stacked magazines. Covey arrived after daylight. Hearing the pilot's half of a conversation with Campbell, Bath could tell Campbell was moving and had NVA in pursuit. Meanwhile, Waugh had crept up to a cliff and peeked down to where 5 NVA chattered while hunting monkeys. Soon, choppers with a bright light team in rappelling gear on board crisscrossed above the treetops and offered to come in for Bath, but he told them to get Strohline first since he was injured worse. Then Bath saw a couple men walking toward him. Thinking they were Waugh and Campbell, he almost waved, but they were NVA. He lay low and they passed, never seeing him. Meanwhile, Strohline tried to vector the rescue Hueys toward him by radio, using the sound of their rotors, but there were several birds, and he'd hear one but talk to another, and everyone became confused. By the time this approach was abandoned, heavy clouds began to build, and, desperate, Strohline threw a smoke grenade, but the air crews still couldn't pinpoint his location. But the NVA saw that smoke. Strohline warned he could see enemy soldiers. With the weather closing and fuel nearly exhausted, the Hueys extracted Campbell and Waugh and left. They came back early that afternoon but were unable to raise Strohline on his emergency radio. Two men rappelled down to Bath and helped him into a stabo rig. Then the Huey lifted away under light ground fire. Strohline's ridge was covered by ground fog. The next day in his hospital bed in Da Nang, one leg in a cast, J.D. Bath looked up to see Billy Waugh and asked which room Strohline was in, explaining he'd been unable to leave his bed to look for him. "We didn't get him," Waugh reported. "Charlie got him." That morning, a Hatchet Force platoon had inserted and found the tree where Strohline had been. Strohline and his parachute were gone, and there were piles of expended AK and Car 15 brass. "Strohline did not go without kicking some NVA ass," Waugh reported. The Hatchet Force found Strohline's map and Car 15 at the bottom of the tree. One AK slug had ricocheted off the Car 15 stock. There was no blood, no bandages. It was the NVA, not Strohline, who had removed the chute, the platoon realized, because a tree limb had been shot off by AKs to free the canopy. The platoon believed they heard movement as they neared the tree, which they took to be NVA pulling away. To recon men, the evidence left one inescapable conclusion. The NVA had captured Strohline, since no SOG man ever would abandon a functional Car 15. The bullet that hit his Car 15 had knocked it from Strohline's one good hand, most men thought, disarming him. Waugh and Bath are absolutely convinced the NVA got Strolon, but Hanoi denied knowing anything about him. That summer of 1971, after months of troubled consideration, Colonel Sadler decided too many things were happening. Too many hot LZs had been chosen at random and away from any known activity. Well, accidents happen, but the repetitious nature of the situation just meant something was wrong. He too decided there must be a mole, and he had to track it down. The footprints had been there for years, begging to be followed. Three of SOG's most critical hatchet force operations had been death traps on the insert LZ. Crimson Tide, with the whole platoon wiped out, the 1967 Oscar 8 raid against the Ho Chi Minh Trail headquarters in Laos, when Charles Wilklow was captured, and the 1969 Kosvin raid, where Jerry Shriver vanished. Only one major raid, 1970's Operation Tailwind, had been a success. Yet many recon missions succeeded, which meant the mole's access was limited in scope or only intermittent. What a clue. A shrewd investigator could compare dates and access and quickly narrow down the suspects. But SOG had no authority to investigate its Arvin counterparts, nor could it even vet them for security clearances. At one point, a declassified SOG report discloses, the U.S. capability to conduct a counter-espionage operation against SOG's Arvin counterpart, STD, was researched. The conclusion reached was that such was not within the capability of the military or CAS Saigon in terms of quality of assets available, to have some assurance that the effort would not be blown. If the South Vietnamese became aware that the U.S. was conducting such an investigation, irreparable harm would be done to counterpart relationships. Behind all enemy moles in South Vietnamese and U.S. agencies was an especially shadowy Trinh Sot entity called Unit B-36. In 1967, the CIA Saigon station uncovered a B-36 mole in their counterpart, South Vietnamese Central Intelligence Organization. From that point, the CIA refused to share agent identities and operational details with their counterparts. Another B-36 operative was a mole that penetrated the 5th Special Forces Group's Project Gamma in 1969. The most highly placed moles could thank Arvin Colonel Pham Ngoc Tho for their achievements. Himself a mole, Tho had headed security for the entire South Vietnamese armed forces prior to his death in 1965, giving him an incredible opportunity to insinuate enemy operatives and purge security files of information. Tho's true allegiance did not become known until after Saigon's fall. In the realpolitik of 1971, Colonel Sadler knew he could not deny Arvin counterparts access to SOG data, and even the mildest accusation of treachery would be politically explosive. The moles, and there was no longer any doubt at all they were there, were certain to raise all sorts of manipulative delays and objections, exploiting bias, pride, nationalism, whatever it took to thwart their exposure. Sadler decided upon an indirect approach and told the Arvin commander he was setting up a polygraph screening of Americans on SOG's staff, that this was a good state-of-the-art security, and he was going to take the first polygraph himself. The Vietnamese colonel could see Sadler was waiting for some reciprocation, but did not offer to participate. Instead, he announced his staff would arrange his own polygraph screening. Within months, every American had been boxed, but the Arvin was still planning its program. Heels were dragging, but the Arvin polygraphs plodded slowly along. At least, Colonel Sadler thought, that would put pressure on the moles and perhaps inspire a degree of caution to reduce their effectiveness. But not all the suspects were Vietnamese. One young American, a non-special forces clerk working at SOG headquarters, had become involved with a questionable Vietnamese woman. One day he was transporting classified SOG documents in a jeep, but arrived at headquarters empty-handed. He claimed somebody drove up on a motorcycle and stole them, Frank Burkhart said. There was many a thief in Saigon, ready to steal watches or cameras or wallets, but there was little larcenous interest in document satchels. Though the clerk was interrogated, nothing came of it. There were repeated rumors, too, of an American sergeant at SOG headquarters suspected of selling data to the enemy, particularly advance information of B-52 strikes, but the rumors were not substantiated. That summer of 1971, while Sadler was polygraphing the SOG staff, South Vietnamese President Thieu's government was rocked by the exposure of the most important mole ever unearthed in Saigon, Huyen Van Trong. It was an especially embarrassing revelation to General Cao Van Vien, South Vietnam's chairman of the Joint General Staff, the equivalent of the U.S., JCS. Back in 1966-68, when Chief SOG Colonel Sing Lob would tell him about upcoming bright lights, Vien assured him he would tell no one. Actually, General Vien had gone to the president's office to brief Thieu's most trusted political assistant, who shared the information with his aide, Huyen Van Trong, the newly exposed mole. No ordinary spy could possibly have relayed word in time to disrupt the bright light, but Trong was so critical and operative that he was believed to have an assigned radio clerk who could transmit messages to Hanoi and certain NVA commands instantly. Despite the security problems in Saigon, operations continued in the field. SOG had yet to completely succeed with the HALO operation, a subject raised by General Abrams, who asked Chief SOG, "When are you ever going to run one that accomplishes the mission?" The CCC commander, Lieutenant Colonel Galen Mike Radke, was in that briefing, and Abrams' words were still fresh in his mind when he sat in the club one night with Captain Jim Storter, the CCC recon company commander, talking about HALO. Inspired by the challenge, Storter insisted that Radke phone Chief SOG and get authority for him to lead another HALO jump. The next morning, Radke called Storter into his office and announced, "I just phoned Chief SOG and we've got permission to run the next HALO operation." Storter was perplexed. "What HALO operation?" "The one you talked me into last night, dammit." Storter, who'd had too much to drink, thought, "God almighty, what have I done?" But it was too late. He would lead SOG's fourth HALO jump. He recruited Sergeant First Class Newman Ruff, Staff Sergeant Miller Moy, and Sergeant Jim Bentley, and took them to Long Ton, where he made an embarrassing confession. "Boys, I got to tell you," Storter said, "I ain't never made a damned freefall in my life." Storter's was undoubtedly SOG's most intense HALO refresher course ever conducted. Sergeant First Class Ronnie Knight volunteered too, but had to drop out after an injury during a practice jump. Fortunately, his NCOs were experienced. Ruff already had a combat static line jump and 25 HALO freefalls. Moy, an accomplished civilian skydiver, would be their base man, and though Bentley had only a few HALO jumps, he could carry his own weight. When they finished training, SOG targeted them for the Plei Trap Valley, northwest of Pleiku, where the NVA was dramatically expanding its presence. Overnight, new roads were being cut into the Plei Trap from Cambodia, just 5 miles away, and rapidly it was becoming another Aishaw Valley. Several thousand NVA were within 5 miles of the HALO team's planned drop zone. Unlike the previous HALO teams, Storter's men had state-of-the-art civilian paracommander chutes, and each man carried a compact Uzi submachine gun. Bentley, who would walk point, took along a suppressor for his Uzi. One night, in early September, the team shooted up at Camp Long Ton. "And here came a jeep racing out," Storter recalled. "Mission's off," the driver shouted, but offered no explanation. The next morning, Storter learned why. The previous day, he'd sent a teletype to Saigon that included his team's names, individual serial numbers, weapons serial numbers, and their drop zone. The previous evening, the NSA had intercepted an enemy radio message with exactly those details, alerting a major NVA headquarters to prepare for their jump. As in the previous HALO compromise, their insertion was rescheduled and the DZ shifted without transmitting the changes to SOG headquarters. Two nights later, they jumped from 16,000 feet into the Play Trap Valley. Were they uptight? He could have taken a team of mules and not pulled a greasy string out of any of our asses, Storter said. Their base man, Miller Moy, spotted the DZ and tracked toward it. The other three saw Moy and followed him. Then Ruff's rucksack came loose and he went into a flat spin, whipping with such force that the capillaries in his eyes burst, making his eyes turn pink, though this did not impair his vision. Dizzy, he could concentrate on just one thing, so he watched his altimeter to ensure he opened his chute at the correct altitude. He knew he was still over Moy, so it would be okay. All of them landed within 30 yards of Moy, exactly in their appointed DZ. We were 100% assembled within 10 minutes of landing and moving, Storter said. They reconned the plague trap for 4 days, and there was never a hint the NVA knew they were there. It was picture perfect, Storter said. For the first time in military history, a unit had skydived behind enemy lines at night, landed without injury, assembled and conducted an entire area recon mission. Chief Sugg was able to report to General Abrams. Riding that success, Sugg launched another HALO insertion a month later, again using a CCC team against an objective on the Cambodian border, this time 25 miles southwest of Ple Khu in the Ayadrong Valley. Led by Sergeant First Class Dick Gross, it included Sergeants First Class Mark Gentry and Bob McNair, Staff Sergeant Howard Sugar, and Master Sergeant Charles Baylor. Jumping from 17,000 feet, the team became separated during descent. Gentry's rucksack came loose, spinning him wildly. Then he had canopy problems and landed away from the rest. Gross and Sugar found each other beside the Ayadrong River, then reached Gentry by radio. He said he'd meet them. It was still dark when Gross heard voices and NVA walking through the thin brush around them. Apparently the NVA already had started looking, he said. I was extremely concerned for the HALO team because, flying above them in an O-2 FAC plane, I could see the weather precluded bringing in fighters or gunships. Besides, until we knew where everyone was, fire support for one man could endanger another. Just after daylight, Mark Gentry walked into a squad of NVA eating breakfast. They went for their guns, but he was faster, shot several, then ran and found a bomb crater to hide in. 2 hours later, the overcast broke. We brought in Cobras and Hueys and extracted the whole team without casualties. It was SOG's last American HALO jump. Two Arvin-led SOG HALO teams jumped near Krathi, Cambodia in October and December 1971 to look for a POW camp. The first team was scattered, the second was discovered on their DZ. Both had to be extracted. Though SOG parachutists landed amid enemy troops, fought, died, broke limbs, became MIA, faced dangers as great as any faced by American paratroopers, their jumps did not meet the U.S. Army's official criteria for a combat parachute landing, so they were not awarded gold stars for their jump wings. Instead, SOG presented each man a jump certificate, which had only ceremonial value. But it doesn't matter, said Cliff Newman, the world's first combat HALO team leader. That isn't why we do these things. And the mole problem was never fully resolved. The Arvin STD polygraphs were still underway when Colonel Sadler rotated home in 1972, though he learned that eventually they uncovered one agent, a young corporal with access to target data. Undoubtedly a throwaway, a low-level operative given up to protect a higher, more important source, the corporal could not possibly have been SOG's only source of compromise for 6 years. Where else they were, Colonel Sadler said, I don't know. 17. SOG stands alone. After the Cambodian invasion, American troop withdrawals accelerated while the remaining U.S. units ceased defensive operations and moved to enclaves near major cities, air bases, and the coast. Except for a few artillery fire bases, no American ground forces remained in South Vietnam's interior. As U.S. units pulled out of the DMZ, Central Highlands, and remote frontiers, Arvin forces, lacking firepower, air power, and sometimes willpower, could not fill the void. So the NVA stepped in, extending their Laotian highways into South Vietnam, creating strategic bastions all along the border. There were more NVA troops than ever, better situated, better armed, and ready to fight, but nobody to oppose them. Nobody except SOG. I maintain that everybody had gone home, and there was nobody in the war but SOG, which is true, said Colonel Roger Petzell, SOG's ground operations chief. There was nobody in this god-dang war but SOG. One of Special Forces' earliest officers, Petzell, in 1952, first adopted the Green Beret, patterned after the berets worn by OSS operatives serving with the French Resistance. 1-0s continued to take risks, Petzell said, because the unit felt like it was our responsibility to protect through the gathering of intelligence and giving people advance warning all the rest of these people in the command who were getting ready to leave, and the South Vietnamese Army. It was also a matter of pride. FOB 2 Recon First Sergeant Billy Greenwood noted, "We still ran missions just as aggressively, just as regular with the same amount of enthusiasm as we always did." It wasn't easy. One afternoon, Lloyd O'Daniels watched a helicopter bring in the body of Sergeant First Class David Baby Huey Hayes. The day they brought him in on strings, his helicopter flew in very slowly, and it took forever to lower his body to the ground. "And this is a guy who had a wife and three kids. God almighty, is it worth it?" he remembered wondering. Worth it or not, alone or not, SOG fought on, continuing to penetrate the enemy's most heavily defended bastions in Laos, the DMZ, and inside Vietnam. Half the missions went smoothly, half did not, with R.T. Washington experiencing it both ways during two recons into Laotian Target Charlie 3 that fall of 1970. Inserting in southern Laos on 5 November, Washington's 1-0, Captain Steve Wallace, took 4 days of careful movement before he, 1-1 Jeff Mousery, and 1-2 Kurt Green, and 3 yards, reached a just-vacated battalion bivouac site. Alert but quiet, they soon crossed a wide trail and discovered a heavy coaxial communications cable. Beyond there, the jungle opened into an enormous rice field, being worked by uniformed NVA. Now the NVA seemed everywhere. In an adjacent little valley, they found an empty field hospital and hundreds of graves, likely casualties from the siege of Dak Seang and Dak Pek Special Forces camps 5 months earlier. By the next afternoon, R.T. Washington heard constant movement, so 1-0 Wallace found a spot to hide overnight. Hardly had they stopped when Mousery shot an NVA tracker. The race was on. The team ran a half mile, waded across a creek, then lay in ambush. Approaching NVA flashlight beams cut the darkness, but the tracker dogs lost the scent. All night, the team sat back to wait until Covey arrived at dawn and directed them to an LZ. En route, they bumped into two NVA on a trail, one carrying a thick ledger, and shot them dead. Mousery grabbed the book just as more NVA arrived. Then they dashed the final 100 yards to the LZ. Minutes later, the NVA attacked. R.T. Washington repelled the attack with grenades and Car 15 fire, then Covey's OV-10 made gun runs. Momentarily, Cobras arrived to add still more fire, then a Huey swooped in. They leaped aboard and lifted away. Looking back, Mousery could see dozens more NVA converging on the now vacant LZ. It had been a hell of a close shave. Later they learned the ledger contained rice-growing reports. Its bearer, a citation said, was a recipient of the coveted American Killer Award. He'd never seen an oak leaf cluster. Saigon congratulated R.T. Washington for uncovering the NVA 28th Regiment's new base area, then tasked them to go back and wiretap that coaxial cable they'd found. Having just escaped by the skin of their teeth, they'd have rather gone anywhere else. On 1 December back they went, stalking cross-country for 3 days to reach the hill where they'd found the cable. That night they slept near the wire and planned to tap it the next morning. By 8 a.m. they were searching for the cable when the point man opened fire on an NVA sentry. Just beyond him, an entire company was eating breakfast. Captain Wallace fired 2 quick shots, which dropped a Chinese advisor. Then an AK slug hit Kurt Green's Car 15, disabling it and injuring his hand. They flashed through an IA, immediate action drill, then ran for all they were worth. They crossed the ridge and took fire from more NVA, dashed away and began evasive turns. Mousery gave Green a .38 revolver so he'd have a working weapon. Then Covey arrived and shot up their back trail while steering R.T. Washington toward an LZ atop a steep knoll. In a few minutes they were there, apparently having shaken off the NVA. When Covey announced the helicopters were 10 minutes away, 1-0 Wallace had Mousery knock down 5 small trees with claymore mines and began chopping bamboo in preparation. Meanwhile, 1-2 Green called in A-1 Sky Raiders against their back trail, just in case any NVA were approaching. They were. Intense fire erupted suddenly near Green. Then Wallace shouted, "He's dead!" Mousery saw his teammate lying still, 3 gaping exit wounds in his back, and NVA massing just beyond him. He could do nothing for Green, but they needed the radio. The 1-1 rushed down, shooting and throwing grenades, squatted behind a tree and covered while a yard grabbed Green's rucksack. A round hit the yard in the pelvis and he slumped over. Mousery fired madly and somehow dragged the yard to safety while another yard recovered the team radio. By now a Huey was landing, just as an NVA platoon assaulted.